This is Using the Whole Whale, a podcast that brings you stories of data and technology in the nonprofit world. My name's George Weiner, your host and the chief whaler of WholeWhale.com. Thanks for joining us. There is a ton of data available about your nonprofit online. Simply just the fact that you're a 501c3 means that you need to publicly file your 1099. But also, you realize that as you connect your organization to LinkedIn, you can then find all of the employees that work for you. When you look at your website code, there's information revealed, your social media accounts that are connected. All of this information is basically sitting online, waiting for people to put it together. Some organizations out there already doing it, like GuideStar and folks like Charity Navigator. There's one in particular that caught my eye. They're kind of new on the scene. They're called CauseIQ. CauseIQ is interesting because they're really taking an advanced look at merging these data together to drive insights. But also, they're a fee-for-service that are helping nonprofits, but also for-profits, connect to the right organizations and understand things about the larger sector. We're talking with Josh Hurd, the CEO and founder of CauseIQ, and we're going to look at it from two perspectives. One, just, as almost like just a tech company. How are you building and thinking about this as a product? What tools are you using to measure success? And then big picture, we find some fascinating insights around small and large organizations and new and old organizations and how they're spending money on tech. So we're going to jump into it and talk with Josh about how he's building CauseIQ. We are here with Josh Hurd from CauseIQ. Josh, tell us a bit about what you do and what the heck is CauseIQ?
Great question. CauseIQ is a tech startup that provides business intelligence on the nonprofit sector. What does that mean? It means that our customers are primarily the service providers that help nonprofits fulfill their mission. So it can be accounting firms, IT firms, consulting firms, even banks and financial advisors. And what our website does is it helps them understand market trends. It helps them understand their clients better so they can provide better services to their nonprofit clients. And also it helps them understand which organizations are out there that really would benefit from perhaps IT consultants or better financial advisors or just the wealth of services that exist to help nonprofits fulfill their missions.
Very cool. And you're the founder and CEO there, correct?
Yep, founder and CEO. Right now we are just about 2 years old, celebrating our 2-year anniversary soon here. And we've got a team of about 4 people here in the United States and then a team about equal in size abroad.
So I found you guys, actually, interestingly enough, just because I was looking for ways of understanding not only my clients, potential leads, of whether or not they were great organizations that Whole Whale wanted to work with. And I noticed that, it was uniquely different than the GuideStars and Charity Navigators out there, and certainly different than looking in, at a 1099. But on the surface, mm-hmm. What separates you from the folks that are already out there?
Yeah, there's a few different things, and I should say that I'm friends with Jacob Harold, and so each of these companies that is providing intelligence on the sector, whether towards foundations or towards the service providers or nonprofits themselves, each of them has a niche and is doing good work in their own way. But what really separates us is that we're looking at specifically at the service providers, because right now they are, the enablers for a lot of the organizations that are out there. But they don't have the tools and the information that they need to best carry out their jobs. So we're focused exclusively right now on equipping them, like I said, with the tools they need. And to do that, we are bringing in a whole variety of different data sources. So whereas GuideStar, let's say, primarily mines the form 990s plus the self-reported information from the GuideStar exchange, We've got our own means of mining the 990. We're also mining A133 audits from the OMB in the federal government. We have a research team that is researching organizations one at a time by looking at their web pages, by looking at all other annual reports and available documents. We're also mining social media streams with Twitter accounts, Facebook accounts, a few other government data sources. We use a few data brokers to fill in the gaps. And I'm sure there's sources I'm missing, but basically we're mining as much as we possibly can. And so that's one piece. But then the second piece is having tools that really make that information usable and actionable from the service provider's perspective. So helping them answer questions like, who's my competition? Who are the clients of, let's say, this accounting firm that my friend runs? Or it could be, what are trends in IT expenditures as a percent of operating budget for certain types of nonprofit organizations? Or even, what organizations exist that are similar to my current clients? Or what are the common characteristics among my current clients, which surprisingly a lot of service providers don't even know?
Yeah, so you're doing this from the service provider perspective and able to do this extra layer of information. You know, I love being able to see things like percent on, you know, technical expenditure and automatically doing that, and like the personnel breakdown where possible, because I think a lot of time, you know, in the same way that we are what we eat, you know, we do what the people in our organization are. You know, if you know, you claim to be this type of organization, but you have no technical people on staff, I get suspicious.
Yep.
So that's really interesting. Can you talk about how you move from big data to intelligence? You talked about business intelligence.
Yeah.
How do you bridge that?
Yeah, and it's tough. It's really tough, and we're still working on it every single day. At the highest level, the way we bridge it, and it sounds cliche, but it's really listening to our customers, because of course they know their markets a lot better than we do, and it's constantly iterating. So we might have a new feature that we think could be useful, like, let's say, what I talked about with automatically finding common characteristics among your existing clientele. So we might roll that out, have like an initial crack at it. Then we get amazing feedback from our customers saying, like, these two parts of it are great, but this one piece is just useless or counterintuitive. And so then it's this constant back and forth, trying to really understand what are tools to make the information useful. And getting more specifically, it is really looking at what are best practices in the sector. Because a lot of times, let's say accounting firms might be doing certain types of searches, certain types of intelligence, certain types of market sizing that IT firms or consulting firms aren't doing. And so a lot of times it's building tools that kind of best leverage the various kind of tips and tricks from different verticals that all serve nonprofit organizations.
Yeah. And if I may, it seems like you also frame how you're synthesizing and displaying information based around questions.
Yeah, at least internally, that's really what we try to do. So, I mean, there's the classic, like in the startup world, there's a classic phrase called like the lean startup, and something called like the minimally viable product, which is thinking, what is a solution for like your customer base? And again, for us, it is the service providers and nonprofit organizations. And it's like, what is the minimal amount of product you can create that gets them using it so that they can provide feedback, so they can help really improve it? And exactly from what you just said, it's all question driven and thinking, what problems do they have that need a solution? What are their pain points? Where are rooms for efficiencies so that we can help them do their jobs better? And sometimes even trying to think one step ahead of our customers. So like I said, taking the knowledge that we have from serving dozens of different companies and really thinking, like, what does not everybody currently know? Like, what can we share that way?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you've been doing this for a couple of years. What are some of the metrics that really matter to you with regard to growth, with regard to engagement? What is helping you drive down the digital highway here?
Yeah, the really big thing for us is looking at engagement with the website, because just the fact that, let's say, a given customer logs in or does a search doesn't necessarily tell us whether they're getting value out of that search. So in that way, it could be the fact that a company doesn't log on to our website for a month, but then they use it very intensely for 3 days. And if they're on the website for 12 hours a day for 3 days straight, and they like either develop lead lists or they develop great internal reports that they can then turn into white papers to help better drive thought leadership in the sector, then that 3 days of super intense use, that like engagement, really matters more than the fact that they might use it 3 days and then not use it for a month. And so in that sense, we're looking at what types of fields they're looking at, what types of searches they're doing, how they're using the data in terms of, like, are they exporting lists of thousands of organizations, or are they pulling up individual organizations' profiles, and really getting understanding of, based on the best practices we know from all of our users, are they kind of ahead of the curve or behind the curve? And of course, if they're behind in the curve, then we like really reach out. We try to have custom consultations with our customers to make sure that they are getting the value that they need out of it. But it's really about quality over quantity, and it's looking at what types of tools they're using and what types of fields they're searching.
So right now, if I were to say, you know, a balance of obviously new customer acquisition versus existing customer engagement, what is the breakdown of importance for your digital strategy right now?
Ultimately, it is existing customer engagement. Of course, wanting to grow, being a tech startup, we are a for-profit company ourselves. We absolutely need sales. Everybody needs sales. But we won't be a successful, sustainable company in the long run if our customers aren't happy, if they're not getting value out of it, if they're not really seeing a positive return on investment for procuring a CauseIQ subscription. So, for example, for me, my first hire was not a salesperson, rather it was a client engagement person. It was somebody who has great previous tech startup experience, who's working with, or who previously has worked with, service providers and major companies, and his sole job is to really make sure that our customers are getting the value that they expect, and then also taking a close look at the product and helping improve the product from a value delivery perspective. And then my second hire, of course, is a salesperson, but the first hire was that really customer-focused client engagement person.
Interesting. Take care of the people that are already inside, because they can, yep, you know, by word of mouth, be your best advocates.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And referrals and introductions are a much larger driver of growth than I'd originally thought. I mean, a good probably fourth of our customer base right now is purely based on referrals and introductions.
Nice. Can you give me an idea of, overall traffic or total customers you have right now? Just to give me an idea of size.
Yeah, I mean, I can't talk super specifics, but right now we have about 24 customers, ranging from like very small 5-person startups up to publicly traded companies that have thousands and thousands and thousands of employees. So, for example, TD Bank is a customer of ours. And of course, TD Bank on the Eastern Seaboard anyway is a very major player, and they've got great commercial banking wing that really helps out a lot of nonprofits. So in terms of the size of the customer, it really depends. And some of our customers have just one seat that maybe the director of marketing or a partner at their firm uses, and some have multiple seats, where it could be like the head of marketing in each region in the U.S. has a seat, or every single staff accountant in their company has a seat. So it really depends on the specific use case, on like how our customers use it that way.
Gotcha. So you mentioned a bit about engagement and the idea of like, yeah, we care about the existing customer engagement, and if someone's spending 3 days on there, that's awesome. Like, how much of that data, right, how do you turn that into action? How do you turn that into the next feature? How do you know you move that from nice but so what into nice but shit, let's do something about this?
Yeah, and a lot of that is really old school. I mean, we keep track of the data. We use a lot of cutting edge systems like Mixpanel and Intercom. And I mean, I could talk about all the kind of tools we use, but I like the last part of your question because at the end of the day, it's a matter of getting that back into the product and making sure we're providing more value. And in that way, it really is all about constant continuing conversations with our customers. And we talk with our customers all the time, and we've tried to establish a culture and establish the relationship with our customers such that they feel like they can reach out whenever and provide ideas absolutely whenever. And so in that case, for example, I mean, the feature I talked about before where you can automatically find clients similar to your current clients, that was directly customer driven through conversations, through following up, even after they're already a paying customer, already in the door, saying what's not working, what's currently working. And of course, we can use our data, and we do use the data on our customers to help drive those conversations. But at the end of the day, it's a conversation with our customers and then looking at trends across all these conversations with all of our customers and really seeing like what leaps out. But there's really nothing magical, nothing that is, you know, based on Web 2.0 technology in order to somehow like know the truth without talking to customers. At the
end
of the day,
Josh, I wanted an answer. I wanted a magical solution. I wanted like you
silver
know.
Bullets. I know. If only there was more silver bullets in the world. Touche.
Darn it. Yep. All right. So no silver bullets. Can you give me? You mentioned MVP, minimum yep. viable product. Can you give me an example of any MVPs that you threw out there in the world, either positive, negative, and how you measured success with that?
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely. So all right, let me think of an MVP on our website. And well, I should say one thing about MVPs is MVPs can be large and small. So an MVP could be an entire website. It could also be a specific feature within the website. And so even though when we started off 2 years ago, the MVP was the entire website, and compared to what we currently have, it was just night and day. But we still use the MVP concept all the time, just testing out specific features versus the entire website. So
what does this MVP actually mean? Well, it comes out of the book The Lean Startup, which we've talked about before, by Eric Ries. And right now, it's really, you know, like a Silicon Valley and startup Bible. In it, it puts forward the idea of the build, measure, learn cycle and saying, how quickly can you build a test, in this case, a test of your larger product idea, put it in the market, measure how it does, and then refine it. How do we learn from that? And the quicker we can build that feedback loop, the happier I think your organization ends up becoming. So let's say, for instance, you wanted to build a, you know, start a new store, just a storefront somewhere, and you're like, all right, we're going to sell paper clips and sunglasses, and that's all we're going to sell. Well, instead of going out and creating the paper clip and sunglass manufacturing, you could build a web page that has that information and says, click here or give us your email if you'd like to buy these things, if you're interested in this. And you know what? If nobody clicks, that's a telltale sign that maybe you should diversify your offerings or focus them differently towards your target audience. So that was definitely Josh's approach to thinking about the early site launch. And then as he goes along, the features he's thinking about building. Just because one person asks for it doesn't mean they're necessarily going to use it.
One great example is that lots of our customers care about lead lists. And so they want to know, let's say, every single CFO for trade associations in DC that have more than $10 million in revenue and work on animal or environment related issues. So you could quickly do that search, but then, like I said, customers want to know who the CFOs are. And like one MVP that we tested is like, what's the best way to get this information into the hands, well, I guess not the hands, but the computers, the spreadsheets, the Salesforce installs of our customers. And we first tried a system where they had to cross-reference an organization search with a people search. It was basically a long, convoluted process, but it was a process that got them the results that they needed. So in that sense, it was the minimally viable way, like the quickest, easiest, perhaps dirtiest way to build this feature out so that they got the data they needed. And while it worked, they hated it. It was complicated. We had to do a lot of hand-holding, and like not good hand-holding, but bad hand-holding in terms of...
We
were not doing nearly as good of a job as we could have because it's an MVP, like you said, like a minimally viable product. But from the insights and conversations that we had and looking at the data as well, that we had from that MVP on how our customers wanted to access the key personnel information, especially if they're exporting hundreds of key personnel at a time, we were able to then iterate and build a much, much, much better like exporting functionality that our customers are currently using, and they like it a lot better. Granted, that being said, we are in the process of planning an even better key personnel export, now getting the kind of critical types of insights we're getting from the second version. And the third version will be like really awesome, really, really awesome. So that's an example of MVP. We just like needed the easiest way to test out how customers would use the feature, how they can get value out of this sort of data. And it was, like I said, nasty, but it got the job done and we got great feedback to improve the product.
Yeah, because there can be a gap over, you know, expressed versus demonstrated user interest. You know, I want a dancing cat feature, damn it. And you're like, all right, you better use this dancing cat feature. It took all of our dev, and then nobody clicks on the dancing cat. Seemed like people clicked on your dancing cat, and you move forward in the true lean impact modeling there. I want to go back a step. Let's have a little quick tool off. You know, Google Analytics is probably in there. You got Mixpanel. You mentioned some others. Give me your soup. What are you using over there?
All right. So in terms of tools or in terms of stack?
Let's go with just the tools.
Tools. All right. So let's see. So we've got Mixpanel, which is really analyzing like what types of features our customers are clicking. So, for example, one thing we created the other month was a report feature where they can download PDFs of organizations, which are much easier to email and print than, of course, a static web page itself. Using Mixpanel, we can get feedback on whenever, or notifications whenever anybody clicks a given like new feature or adds a search filter. And that way we know in general what the trends are with types of searches, what filters they're doing, what types of organizations they're looking at, so on and so forth, which is really important for us as we improve the product to make sure that people can get value out of it. We're also using Intercom, which is great for communicating with customers. So for example, when you log in for the first time, there's a little message that pops up that shows you a video introducing you to the search interface and helping you understand kind of which parts of the websites do what sort of functions. And also in Intercom, we use it if there's any type of notification. Like one common notification is if you do an export, it usually takes a minute or two for the backend service to actually export the data. And after that export's done, there's a little Intercom pop-up notification saying like, hey, here's the export, click on this to download the CSV file. So that's Intercom, which, like I said, we use for messaging. We use a great tool called Sentry, getsentry.com, for air tracking. And so if for some reason an error occurs on the website, we get instantly notified. We can see the entire stack trace, and that means like all the code and all the variables that led to that, and that helps us debug the error as quickly as possible. We use New Relic to monitor our servers and the application itself to see what server load is like, whether there happens to be a spike, or also if we need to improve, let's say, the speed of some aspect of the website that is just functioning too slowly. And so using New Relic, we can very quickly in and seeing like if a server is overloaded or what pieces of the application are taking more time versus less time. We use Salesforce to keep track of most of our both pipeline and existing customers and really kind of measure engagement, looking at how often they've logged in, what types of searches they're doing, so on and so forth. And that's really important for us to know, like I said, again, so that we can best serve our existing customers and, you know, get new sales in as well. We use Zendesk for customer support, transition from an old school, just pure email based system to actually have these emails and these conversations happening and being recorded in Zendesk, which is great for institutional memory and really kind of identifying those best practices. And of course, Google Analytics, but really we don't use Google Analytics all that much after a customer is in the door and using the product. We mainly use Google Analytics to look at how people are getting to the website and then what types of pages they're looking at in terms of like the random traffic from SEO or email campaigns. And that's, I'm looking at the tabs in my browser right now, but that's about it.
He's just manically opening them all. Like, perfect, everything's okay.
Yep.
So let me take a step back and just ask, you know, you've got, you know, this kind of like a big data play analysis working across the nonprofit sector. You know, why the hell did you create this thing? What is your larger vision and hope that this has on the sector at large?
Yeah. So right out of college, I worked for a nonprofit out west in my home state of Montana. And I was just like a little researcher, you know, fresh 22-year-old. And that's when I first encountered the realm of nonprofit data, because a lot of my job was to research the sector itself to understand alliances and employment impacts and trends across the sector. And I spent a ton of time in the Form 990 and just constantly banged my head against the wall because I couldn't easily get the types of insights I needed from a research perspective. So that's where the whole like nonprofit and nonprofit data part fits in, is just having that firsthand experience on the ground. After that job, I went to grad school at the University of Chicago, got a master's in public policy from the Harris School there, and was recruited by Deloitte, the major consulting firm, to join their federal practice here in Washington, D.C. And while there, I had quite a few federal agencies who were my clients, and a lot of the consulting I was doing was like analytical, financial analyses, predictive modeling, that sort of thing. But when I was there, I saw the types of tools that major companies like Deloitte have in their toolbox to better understand their clients, to understand market trends, to do prospect research, and those sort of things. And there's these amazing tools for publicly traded companies, for looking at federal agencies, for looking at state and local governments, but there really weren't any tools looking at the nonprofit sector, both C3, C4, C6, et cetera, the nonprofit sector broadly construed. And it was really putting one and one together, because I had that on the ground experience working for nonprofits myself and doing research on the sector myself back in Montana. But then I saw that, I mean, tools like that are possible and they do exist and companies are buying them and they do help them provide better services to their clients. And so that was kind of like the spark, aha type moment. And at that point, it was just talking to as many of my friends and acquaintances and anybody in my network I could, learning more about their specific needs. And eventually, you know, I got enough interest. I worked some nights and weekends developing a lot of the tools, because I'm a self-taught programmer and I'm fortunate enough to be able to build the product that you see in front of you today. And then I quit my job, secured an investor, and just started having to go at it.
That's awesome. And, you know, you look at a tool like Hoover's and you're like, of course, this provides tremendous value to, you know, connecting people that should be connected in the marketplace. And I like it. And that's obviously like how I found you. I'm like, shit, this is just head and shoulders above a lot of other things. And it's going to help me find better quality folks and understand more about their pain points.
Yep.
To shift gears toward the fact that you're looking at big data across the sector, what sort of macro trends are you seeing that maybe surprise you, maybe regard to technology, expenditures? What are you seeing in the sector as a whole as you now analyze the, you know, volumes of big data on them?
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting. I was actually doing some research in preparation for the podcast, mainly looking at young organizations, like let's say coming into existence after the year 2000, and comparing them to older organizations. And it seems like there's really a fundamental shift in terms of how they view IT expenditures and what products and services that they are procuring. So, for example, and the crazy statistic is that younger organizations holding revenue constant spend more on IT as a percent of their operating budget than older organizations. And so, for example, with organizations with between about $10 and $20 million in revenue, all C3s, for organizations that have been founded since the year 2000, they spend an average of 1% of their operating budget on IT, whereas organizations that were founded before 2000 only spend a 0.5% on average of their operating budget on IT. And at first, that was really counterintuitive to me, looking at that type of trend, because you would think that older organizations, having been around for longer, might be, you know, more comfortable spending more money on IT. But at least my hypothesis, in talking with a lot of my friends who are still in the nonprofit sector themselves, I think they have similar hypotheses, is that younger organizations are more likely to view IT as an investment, something that helps them reach their constituents to better provide services and fulfill their mission, whereas perhaps older organizations just use it as a cost center, something to be minimized. So that's kind of one of the biggest kind of interesting trends I've noticed across different types of nonprofits. And that type of trend is also reflected elsewhere. So, for example, younger organizations are more likely to use different IT service providers than the like older organizations. So the younger ones are still using Blackbaud, they're still using Network for Good, they're still using Salesforce, but they're more likely to use younger organization or younger startup technologies as well. So it could be from Get Classy for fundraising, could be Salsa Labs, like any of these younger, more startup-y type platforms that, of course, serve nonprofits. And we've also found this trend looking at social media. So, for example, younger organizations holding revenue constant, but younger organizations have more Twitter followers. So organizations founded after the year 2000 have an average of about 12,000 Twitter followers, whereas older organizations founded before the year 2000 only have an average of about 8,000 Twitter followers. And so there's just like almost, I'm not going to call it a sea change because it's not that big, but there really is a difference between the younger and older organizations on how they're using technology and how they're approaching IT expenditures. And I think that's an opportunity for the older organizations to kind of catch up, and also an opportunity for service providers to help these older organizations really, I mean, I guess you could say, better compete, but it's, end of the day, it's not about competing. It's about fulfilling their mission, because these older organizations are still doing great work. Like, they're absolutely doing amazing work, but it's almost like they're getting left behind in terms of best practices for the sector when it comes to IT.
Man, these are, I mean, I'm wildly fascinated, and I absolutely see it in our work. You know, we're talking about a nonprofit sector that's been around for quite some time, but then growing up now over the past literally 10 years, 2005, YouTube came out. This idea of being able to leverage a larger body of tech tools, of data, and of outreach is baked into the raw ingredients of the mission, vision, and goals of an organization that is founded in this age rather than one that has grown into it and possibly looks at it more as a fad. You look at a Salvation Army, and they're like, you know what? We've seen this before. It was called the fax machine. We've seen this before. It was called, like, they've been around and they have seen it. Mm-hmm. So I feel like there is a much slower rate of adoption just because, you know, they've seen a lot of fads come and go, while if you're born into it, you're like, this is the be-all, end-all. I don't know if you can speak to any sort of acceleration or change in adoption or trends. that, you know, would support anything like that?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question, because I mean, it's hard to know like what specifically could be an inflection point, what causes that. I mean, I'm sure a large part of it is based on who are the employees of the organization. And if you're a younger organization, you're probably more likely to be scrappy. You're more likely to hire kids out of college, kind of like the nonprofit that hired me right out of college. And especially with, you know, employees in their early 20s, mid-20s, even late 20s and early 30s now, they were raised with technology. They were raised on Facebook, on Twitter, and they see the potential that that has. Whereas if you're an older generation, then it's, I want to say it's alien, because of course we all know like plenty of people in their 50s and 60s and 70s who are just complete rock stars on Twitter. So of course there are exceptions, but there's just kind of a different culture behind it. But in terms of specific like pinpoints, I really don't know. That's a tough one.
No, it's certainly not an easy one. I love that you integrate with LinkedIn and pull in personnel. It's just, you know, it's brilliant to understand who's working at the organization. Do you have any insight into, you know, who is hiring data analysts or technical staff? Does that sort of correlate with, you know, expenditure when you're talking about, you know, the 1% versus 0.5%? Newer organizations are getting data analysts or that type of trends for personnel?
Oh, that's a great question. I could totally pull that up if I had another hour here to do a few searches to see what was there. Yeah, because you have the data. I've never done that query before, though. That is a great idea.
But, well, you know what? I'm going to do a break-in and follow you up on that question.
Yeah, no, totally, totally.
Personnel. And it's data time. We tracked down the information here, and actually the results weren't conclusive. So here's what he was able to do. He looked at 2,500 nonprofits before founding and after founding of the year 2000. And these are 501c3s with 1 million to 10 million in revenues before and after. And the personnel data that they showed with relevant titles that would indicate that they were, you know, on the tech team or involved with web development or data analysis ended up being pretty even. They found the new organizations with 109 on average relevant titles, and then later with 125 matching titles. So they're pretty darn close, and you know, you could refine the search term. So it wasn't actually indicating that newer organizations, folks that were founded after 2000, had more. But this may actually been indicative of something else he found while looking at this, is that the organizations that were in this same group of, you know, 2,500 before and 2,500 after with 1 million to 10 million in revenue, they actually found that older organizations tended to have more employees. A median of 53 part-time and full-time employees for older organizations versus 25 for new organizations, which may be somewhat related to efficiencies that new organizations get with technology, and it's more integrated across. So definitely more research to be done, but I mean, this is just the tip of the iceberg for some of the fascinating research that can be done to identify what's going on with regard to macro trends in the nonprofit sector. I love geeking out to this stuff. Yeah, no, I think this is the type of thing, you know, I, you know, come up with questions on the spot, and you realize the power of suddenly, like, shit, you know, it's there if you ask the right questions, and then that may lead us to focus our content differently toward different organizations. So, you know, getting back to that, like, why the hell did you build this thing? I think even on our conversation breakdown, it helps us understand that a bit more. All right, I want to change gears again, and we're going to jump in the hot tub time machine.
All right.
Not literally, because that'd be weird, and our electronics would break. But look, we're going to go back 2 years, and you get to have like a sit down to be like, hey, you know, young Josh from two years ago who has more hair, less stress.
Yep.
What advice would you give that guy?
I would probably say, concentrate on more specific verticals. Rephrased, it's better to help a smaller subset of service providers, but like fundamentally changed the way they conduct business development and how they approach research on their markets and information they need to serve their clients. So concentrate on a smaller vertical and just knocking that vertical out of the park versus casting a wider net. Because it took us a while to really kind of find our groove in terms of what was the mix of information that we're mining, what were the specific tools and analytical layers on top that our customers find useful and that have a positive ROI that they're willing to pay thousands of dollars for. So I think that would be the answer. And which vertical specifically it was, I'd have to put some more thought into. Perhaps it would be just tackle trade associations, because there's a lot of service providers that solely focus on trade associations. And given that we're located in Washington, D.C., there's lots of those organizations here. So it could be a vertical like that, but it could also be a vertical of, let's say, just IT firms or just accounting firms or just financial advisors. So yeah, that's probably the biggest thing, because then like I could like very much focus on more particular data sets, on analyses and cleaning of the data, because cleaning of the data, as you know, is easily the most underlooked and most difficult part out there of this whole data mining, turning raw data into information and intelligence type aspect. So then could be more focused on specific types of data cleaning, specific types of tools that really, you know, are absolutely needed by that market. And then also it means I'd have to process fewer organizations. So for example, if it was just trade associations, then we'd be only looking at roughly 10,000-ish organizations versus, let's say, all 501c3s, all traditional charities, in which case you're looking at hundreds and hundreds of thousands.
Yeah, that type of focus always helps in the beginning, but sometimes it's just hindsight being 2020. You're like, you fool, just focus on this, type of group, the 501c3s, perfect, done.
But also then you don't know ahead of time, like, number one, which verticals exist to begin with. You've got a good guess, but as I said before, a lot of our growth has been through introductions, referrals from people saying, oh, geez, like I have a friend who is an accounting firm. Have you ever thought about selling to accounting firms before?
By the way, I have that friend.
And so in that case, a lot of kind of how the businesses grow and happen is serendipitous and based on relationships and networks and really nurturing those. And so it's definitely a fine line between concentrating certain verticals so you can do those very, very well versus keeping an open mind as to like which verticals that might be to begin with.
All right. Next question. There's a lot of platforms that seek to answer this very difficult question of how do we quantify, you know, impact? How do we quantify truly the quality of the nonprofit vis-a-vis, you know, the shittiest form? And that's a technical term of overhead, right? Like, what percent of your money happens to go toward a thing you randomly classify as overhead as a factor of quality? So let's say, you know, someone walks up with multi-million-dollar whatever, and they say, Josh, how would you solve this problem of quantifying impact across the nonprofit sector in a way that I could potentially analyze and draw insight from?
Yeah, no, it's a great question, and it's, I mean, when
Josh,
I think
there's millions of dollars riding on this.
Millions of dollars. Of course, like putting the UChicago like nerd hat on, I say having randomized control trials where you have control groups and you have groups that you have different experimental treatments with. It could be like after school programs, could be like homeless feeding, education, whatever. But I think the biggest toughest nut to crack is creating apples to apples comparison. That's how you know that one organization is doing a great job, but comparing that one organization against the nonprofit sector as a whole, then that is horribly difficult. and probably actually counterproductive because it does an injustice to everybody. So, I mean, if I could magically, I mean, let's say $100 million, let's make it more fun, but $100 million to measure impact, I would, well, number one, I wouldn't concentrate in the sector as a whole. I'd concentrate in specific groups of organizations that I think are easiest to compare, but more importantly, are the most important. Or not, I want to say most important, but let's say have the largest potential to gain by knowing this information. You know, from the econ hat, having the, like, you know, greatest marginal impact of what they're doing. And really just for every single group, have a randomized controlled trial. I mean, it's crazy. It's audacious. But if, let's say, you're looking at, like, after-school youth, I have a friend who's doing amazing work in, like, building up future young leaders, especially from at-risk neighborhoods, you know, smart kids who are amazing, but who just haven't been given opportunities. The organization's called YSA, Youth Service America. And, you know, so if we could equip them with a randomized controlled trial, then that would be, like, amazing. And then let's say every single other organization in that kind of issue area, then, you know, take 5 years, and yeah, it would cost millions and millions of dollars, but then you have amazing data that you can then act on. And I think especially when it comes to measuring impact, we get impatient and we think about time horizons of 1 year or 2 years or maybe 5 years. But the idea that 5 years is a long time horizon when you're talking about human lives is, I think, kind of myopic, because if we get these studies together, really the most potential, the largest potential for impact is if we're measuring people's entire lives. If we're looking at 10 years, 20 years out, and then really thinking about feeding this data back to organizations as a whole, improving the sector as a whole, then there's huge potential for improvement. But again, that kind of changes the mindset of how we measure impact. But what you're saying with the whole overhead ratio, I mean, luckily the leaders in the sector, you know, it could be Jacob Harold at GuideStar or others, are really trying to dispel that overhead myth, and absolutely rightfully so, because, you know, if there's an amazing person who will fundamentally change the way an organization achieves their mission, then yeah, of course it's worth $250,000 to pay them. And that talent should be retained and should be compensated accordingly so that they can do a good job and so that the best talent is absolutely put in the right positions. And so the idea that somehow because you work for a nonprofit that you shouldn't pay for good talent is just ridiculous.
Yeah. I have fun putting people on the spot. Nice job there, but I don't feel like I got a silver bullet there either.
No.
Josh? All right.
Give me the qualifiers.
All right, Josh. final question here.
Yep.
What is something you think you should stop doing at your organization?
What should I stop doing?
What do you want to stop doing?
I saw this question on your list and did not think about it too much. Give me 10 seconds.
This is what post is for. And I'll edit some Jeopardy here. Will be done.
Yep. Do. Okay. I would say we need to stop being timid with the way that we approach new features and new data sets, because right now we spend tons and tons of time cleaning data, especially when it comes to qualitative data. So think of, like, mission descriptions, or it could be like free form fill in the blank type fields, what type of investments organizations have on their books. And we tend to err on the side of not including data versus including it if it means that there might be misspellings or there might be, you know, feature that's incomplete. And I think in that sense, we need to, like I said, just stop being timid and push information out there. Granted, with full disclosures on where it comes from, how it's been cleaned, so on and so forth, but really get it in front of our customers as quickly as possible so that they can provide feedback on whether it's useful, on ways that they'd like to see it cleaned or presented or analyzed, and really have more of a test kind of anecdotal driven development cycle versus thinking too much on our end on what customers want and being kind of more timid with data cleaning and just putting stuff out there versus just going for it and testing it and getting feedback.
Seeing how the audience responds, a little bit more MVP action on the big data.
Yeah, because of course
in front of the humans.
Yeah, because we did MVP, of course, like I said, a lot and like little features here and there, but it's, I mean, data is so tricky because some people want data that's absolutely clean no matter what. And some people want just anything because
something's better than nothing.
And we have customers that are in both camps, which, you know, makes it a little bit difficult for us. But I really think that erring on the side of having data out there, even if it's not perfect, but having data out there so that our customers can use it and really derive value of it is the better side to err on than keeping data internally out of worries that there might be like a misspelling or something miscategorized or kind of some other type of imperfection in the data.
Yeah, well, data's a fickle temptress indeed. I love what you're doing. Finally, how do people find you and how do people help you, Josh?
So they find us through www.causeiq.com, CauseIQ.com. You can email me, Josh at causeiq.com, Josh at causeiq.com. We're on Twitter, causeiq. I'm on Twitter at Josh Hurd, H-U-R-D. And how they can help us. We really love hearing pain points that people have with data and ways they think, like if they had a silver bullet, if they could just conjure up like wild dreams about how they would use data and how it would look. And this is particularly important right now because we're revamping a lot of our analytical market sizing, trend analysis, and benchmarking tools, cranking out new versions that will be much more interesting and more impactful. And so just getting feedback on what that like ideal world, best case scenario type of analysis and data product would look, then that is just incredibly helpful for us to hear those anecdotes. And then also in particular from the nonprofits themselves, I mean, we do eventually want to get into actually serving nonprofits directly and helping them better understand their organizations and their peers. And so hearing from either a board member perspective or from kind of a C-suite leadership perspective on what type of benchmarks matter to them, what type of peer analyses matter, what type of market research questions they ask themselves but they can't answer or they need to spend $100K on consultants to answer. Those type of anecdotes are just incredibly useful for us as we grow our company and better serve our customers.
Well, that's amazing. Thank you, Josh, for being on the cast here and for sharing your wisdom.
Yeah, thank you very much for the opportunity.
It's helpful to see how other industries treat the nonprofit sector in creating marketplaces around the data that exists, but also their approach. You realize the power of data hygiene here, because in disparate sources, technically, all of this information already existed online. We already had nonprofit websites and LinkedIn and 990s, and it was there, but it wasn't all consistent, organized, and then made available in a way that people could search it. So think about your own industry. Think about the inefficiencies that exist, and what would happen if you were to take this approach, this model of organizing data in a way that it was consistent and accessible, and then think about the insight you'd be able to drive. And feel free to steal some of the approaches, of course, that Josh was nice enough to share there. And keep in mind, your big data is out there, and people are watching. We're going to have links to all of the helpful resources and sort of web optimization tools available. This is episode number 32, so you can go find that on wholewhale.com/podcast. As always, thanks so much for joining us. This has been Using the Whole Whale. For more resources on today's show, please visit wholewhale.com/podcast and consider following us on Twitter @wholewhale. And thanks for joining us. As always, our intro and outro music by the very talented Greg Thomas Band, and also music coming from Sonic Avenues. Hope you enjoyed it.